May it please the court, Charles Kessler for Shelby Moffitt, the appellant. Wouldn't it be nice if we all knew what the CAB thought of Moffitt's receipts as exculpatory evidence?
The last thing I want to know is what's in the thoughts of the CAB members.
Well, had they written...
Some combination of sexual fantasies and goodness only knows what else.
Nonetheless, we do not, and instead we are left with a one-sentence opinion from the CAB regarding its
findings.
Let me
ask you a jurisdictional question.
Okay.
Do we have any? There's no certificate of appealability in this case, and one might think that in collateral attack, certificate of appealability is essential. Now, I understand that our Walker case dispenses with the need for certificates of appealability in situations like this.
Correct.
But since Walker was handed down, unanimous panels in five other circuits have disapproved Walker. Perhaps we need to rethink that question.
It's certainly something that you might address in a future case when it has been briefed by the respondent, I would think.
It's a jurisdictional question.
Yes. But here we have proceeded under you'd have to go back and make it retroactive in the sense that...
Jurisdictional decisions are always retroactive.
What would the result? The district court has allowed it to proceed under Walker versus O'Brien specifically by order. And so a certificate of appealability was never sought. If you'd like, we can go back and start this whole process again and seek a certificate of appealability, but it seems as though this perhaps isn't the right case for doing that, I would think. So that's my answer to that jurisdictional question. Now, on the merits, we have two violations of Wolf that have occurred by the CAB decision. One is essentially inarguable. It issued a one-sentence opinion 20 years after, Redding versus Fairman, quarter century after Wolf. Indiana still produces a one-sentence opinion that gives absolutely no reasons at all for the guilt of the offender. And
you might want to address the question whether that issue has been preserved within the state administrative process.
All right.
Was the, let's say, shortcoming or shortness of reasons ever given as a reason within the state system to undo the decision, to reverse the initial level decision?
That is to say, if I understand, Your Honor, that did Mr. Moffitt raise that question
within the state administrative
within the state system. Administrative question.
Obviously raised it now within
he's
the
raised
judicial
it.
System.
Well, he the short answer to your question is no. Now, what he did do is in his very first appeal, he pointed out that the CAB's failure to consider these receipts is questionable. And so he directed the attention of the administrative appellate authorities to the CAB's decision, and particularly its decision with regard to exculpatory evidence, which there is nothing there. Now, having said that, I think it's important to note that, number one, that this error was patently obvious, particularly since Moffitt had directed the attention to this particular defect in the CAB's reasoning and its procedure. It's a clearly established right to have a reasoned opinion, and as he proceeded through the administrative process, the responses that he got from Warden Anderson and later on from Administrative Assistant Penfold, never talk about waiver. They never talk about his issues, per se, that he more specifically or more fully raised with regard to notice and so on of the attempted tracking charge. Instead, what they say is, I find no procedural or due process errors. I find no due process errors. They're just filtering it through, supposedly, or conceptually, theoretically, hopefully, through Wolf, and, you know, erroneously finding no procedural errors. The second thing I guess I would like to say about the preservation point within the state administrative process is that, obviously, from the question itself, this is an administrative process. So it's going to be judged under the rules of administrative law, and these are agencies and not courts. And as this court's recent decisions have come down, it's clear that in many, many contexts, the Indiana disciplinary boards are not going to be treated the same as a legally expert state court would be. So, given that, we turn to the issue, we turn not to exhaustion per se, but to issue exhaustion and whether or not this court should enforce issue exhaustion in an administrative proceeding like the one Mr. Moffitt was subject to. Now, in the briefs, we've talked about McCart and we talked about the balancing decision. Now, it may be true that, you know, as Markham discusses, that Indiana has the right to adjudicate these cases merely through an administrative process. But that's going to have consequences for the way that we do, the way that you are going to have to do, the balancing that McCart demands, in which we find an individual is deprived of liberty, and the reason that we would normally require him to present the issue seems a little bit excessive. I mean, he could present a constitutional argument, a very fully developed constitutional argument to Warden Anderson, but are we really going to get a lot out of Warden? I mean, ultimately, it's still going to come up here, and are we really going to get a lot of benefit from Warden Anderson's opinion?
That's the question. How do we know it's still going to come up here? If the argument is made to the warden or within the hierarchy that the CAB is not given adequate reasons, one logical thing that can happen is a remand to give better reasons, and then the problem goes away.
That's right, Your Honor, but at the same time, I mean, if we look at the situation of this case, this error is so obvious. I mean, this is all about, ultimately, about agency expertise and whether or not we're going to respect the agency expertise by compelling individuals to bring up the issue before them. Now, it's sort of a double bind, the way I see it. If they have the legal expertise...
Well, that's not responsive. That's not responsive to Judge Easterbrook's question. Even if they're not particularly expert, they may be able to correct some of their own errors and spare us the task. So if you bypass them completely, that whole level of potential error correction is lost.
I agree, Your Honor, but Mr. Moffitt didn't bypass them completely. He did everything in a timely fashion. He presented all facts. It's not an issue of facts. It's an issue whereby the facts were presented there, and it was a patently obvious constitutional violation that's been known and been directed to all of these prison officials who have a positive duty to comply with Wolf, and he wasn't hiding anything, he wasn't hiding the ball, and yet they decide there are no procedural and no due process errors. I honestly think that this is that there's no expertise there to protect.
No, the issue isn't expertise. The issue is having an orderly system of appeals where you try to get problems straightened out at the lowest level possible. The more patently obvious the unfairness of the procedure is, the more likely it is that it will be corrected at a lower level if it's you know, flagged to the attention of the warden.
Well, that's one side of the equation, Your Honor. But then there's the other side of the McCarthy
question. Equation. Whether the prisoner wants it corrected. Normally, we think of both administrative officials and judges as responding to statements of dissatisfaction. You can easily imagine a prisoner who didn't really want the CAB's explanation fleshed out because he thought it could get worse for him. That a fuller statement of the explanation would jeopardize the other arguments he was raising on the administrative appeal.
Well, whether or not it would be worse for him, and he certainly wanted them to discuss his receipts and what they thought of it, it certainly would be better for all of us as we work through the appeal for them to have dealt with it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Keckler. Mr. Steiner?
May it please the Court. I think I would start with this issue that was just being discussed, and that's the question of whether he, Mr. Moffitt, presented this issue to the...
The logical place to start is whether there is appellate jurisdiction, and that depends on the certificate of appealability problem.
I would agree with you, Your Honor. I think because of this court's previous decisions and the fact that this case was accepted, the parties had not dealt with that issue.
I think
it would be a good
that,
one.
But it is still a jurisdictional question. It's actually within the last 3 months that three of the courts of appeals have expressly disapproved Walker, said that they thought we got it wrong. It's always hard as it may be to think that the Seventh Circuit ever gets any issue wrong. It's always conceivable, so how should we proceed, do you think?
Well, I think as I look at this situation, we haven't argued this, but we would be willing to if the court would be interested in further briefing on that issue.
That's one possibility. The other possibility is that this case actually has in it sufficient constitutional merit to call for a certificate of appealability if that standard were applied, and we could duck the problem here by issuing a certificate of appealability. Another way of going about it.
I agree, Your Honor.
But is it your view that the case has that amount of, right, the magic words are substantial constitutional questions?
Well, I think there's a serious question in this case about whether the real substantive issues should be properly before this court, because of the procedural part of
Walker matters in the set of cases where an appeal is taken, but the substantive criteria in the statute for a certificate of appealability could not be met. So that would raise the question whether, in your view, the substantive criteria for a certificate of appealability in this case are met.
I understand, Your Honor. I suspect, but again, I would be guessing because I can't speak for what the district court might have done or might do.
I'm not asking what you predict judges would do. I'm asking what you think.
I think
are the criteria met or aren't they?
I think the criteria are probably met in this case, Your Honor. I think that if this is the kind of case that probably the court would view as one that would be reasonable to review and make some sort of a determination about. Going on from there, I do think there is a serious question in this case whether the substantive issues are in any way before this court, at least the issue regarding the short or terse disciplinary report that was made by the conduct board in this case. I think that the record is pretty clear that Mr. Moffitt did not in any way raise this issue, and as previous discussion was indicating, I think that in fact that matter could have been addressed and often is addressed, those kind of issues often are addressed by superintendents or the reviewing authority of the Department of Correction. They're done by having rehearings or just sending it back for a new disciplinary report to be prepared a hearing report that would be more substantial than the one in this particular case. And I think that there are important interests that that should require prisoners who are appealing these kinds of disciplinary cases to present their issues so that these, particularly these kinds of issues, can be dealt with, as you say, at the lowest possible level, because they often are and they will be. And in fact, this is a case, I think, if we look beyond that a little bit, and beyond the report a bit, when we look at a record like this, when the district court, when this court, when parole authorities look at a record like this, they have, of course, the disciplinary hearing report, but they'll also have the underlying conduct report or reports from the officers or witnesses in the case. And we have written reports in this case in addition to the conduct report. And those written reports, I think, pretty clearly indicate that there was at least some evidence, as the standard is in these cases, and probably quite sufficient evidence, that Mr. Moffitt brought some contraband into the prison on this particular day as, through the visits. And because we have that evidence in this case, I think that this is a case that if we would allow it to be reviewed, or we would bring these issues through the review process and require them to be brought through the review process, we could correct any minor errors and still make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have a situation here where there seems, as much as in any of these kind of cases, disciplinary cases in prisons, that we have a man who probably committed this offense that he was charged with, attempted trafficking, and there's no reason to circumvent the appellate process that you have and the administrative process and say that a person can bring any sort of issue that he wants in district court without having given the administrative authorities a chance to do something about it. But I'd also go on and point out that beyond the fact that there was a procedural default and there wasn't any presentation to the administrative body, there's a waiver here in the district court. At least I think that this court ought to determine that there's a waiver under this court's Jackson case. This court is generally required state prisoners, when they're bringing this kind of conduct case, to present the issues that they want the district court to decide in the petition, or if they don't present it in the petition, to seek an amendment of their petition, or do something that makes it clear both to the district court and to the respondent in the case that we have an issue to deal with. In this case, this issue is not clearly, it was clearly not presented at all in the petition.
Petition for collateral review have to identify these issues. Petition for collateral review ought to say something like, I'm stuck here in prison and my being stuck here violates my constitutional rights. But one would think that the issues get identified sometime later in the case. You don't have to go back and amend the petition every time you get a new legal theory.
Well, in this particular setting, we have a petition. We respond, ordinarily, is the procedure that occurs. And then frequently, although not required, the prisoner will file a reply. In this case, it was basically in the form of a brief, arguing some issues. I don't think that the issue, you could say, was clearly presented at that point, and it wasn't clear that the respondent had an opportunity to say anything about that or even recognize there was something to talk about in this particular case. And I think that's one reason why we ought to follow the rule that I think this court set out in the Jackson case and require, to some degree, that prison inmates, when they're bringing this kind of disciplinary case, say something in their petition relating to a particular claim that allows
people to
know.
Requiring them to plead more elaborately than an ordinary legally represented civil plaintiff?
Oh, absolutely not, Your Honor. Of course they would not be required to do that. And sometimes we have arguments among counsel, obviously, about what issues have been presented in a case. But generally we look back at the complaint to try to make a determination whether that issue was in some way fairly presented in the case.
No, we don't, actually. No,
sometimes
don't.
Sometimes it can be through evidence.
Only claims have to be in complaints. Issues don't have to be in complaints.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. I'd like to go on and make another point about this case, and that is regarding this conduct report, the hearing report in this case. It was terse, but it does point in the direction of the reports that were made by the officers. It's really a fairly simple case. That's what I want to point out. Not nearly as complex as counsel for Mr. Moffitt has indicated that it is, because it's a situation where we had eyewitness reports from several correctional officers about what they saw Mr. Moffitt take to the visit and what they found on him after he came out of the visit. And we have Mr. Moffitt denying this happened, and the only allegedly complicating factor in the case being some receipts for some neck chains, but we have no indication at all with those receipts that those were the neck chains that Mr. Moffitt had on the day in question, or that those neck chains, or even one of them, was the one that he wore into the visit. I think that's really not relevant in any way, those particular receipts. So we have a case that's somewhat like the Saints, the Colbert case, where we have a pretty straightforward situation. Correctional officers see man wear one neck chain into a visit. He comes out with three. That appears to be fairly clearly a situation of trafficking or attempted trafficking, as he was ultimately found guilty of. And given the fact that the report pointed towards that report, cited the witness statements, I think that the report, although terse, given the basic requirements of these cases, probably meets the standard, although barely.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Steiner, and thank you to Mr. Keckler. And you were handling the case at our request, are you not? And so we thank you for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your clients.